Good evening, everybody. We are back here with a brand new edition of Brian Alvarez After Dark. We've been off for 2 weeks, and in that time, I've been inundated with messages that I need to bring the opening music back. So it's back, and we're here with a great show today. We're going to be joined in about a half hour by Nicholas De Leon of CrunchGear.com. We're going to be talking technology. And what better day to talk technology than the day that the iPad 2 hit store shelves? We're going to be talking about that, and we're actually going to be talking about the iPad with Carl Stern as well. He is here on the line. And Carl, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brian. Looking forward to... I'm not immediately getting a new iPad, but my best friend is getting one of the new ones, so I can't wait. I'm actually going to check it out as soon as he... brings it, he's going to stop by here and let me see it immediately.
Actually, probably by the time everybody is listening to this, many people will already have their hands on the iPad 2. And I did read some reviews, a lot of people talking about it. It's obviously it's thinner, it's twice as fast. There are people down on the camera, but to me, the size of the iPad, I mean, I can't personally even think of using it as a camera, especially if you've got an iPhone or a digital camera or any other camera that has a 5-megapixel camera on it. I don't really see the point of holding up a giant iPad to take photographs, but, you know, I would presume that iPad 3, when it comes out, is going to have a much better camera, I would presume.
Well, but the thing about the camera, I can kind of understand it. I wouldn't want to use it as a digital camera or anything like that. But, I mean, there's been several times I wish I, you know, to load up a photograph to Facebook or something like that, some sort of social media, or even eBay. Of course, I do a lot of eBay stuff. And so a lot of times I'll have that because it's portable carried with me, and I'll be doing something related to that and need a picture. So it would be handy. I could actually see where you wouldn't want to use it as a digital camera, but it sure would be handy to have one on there.
And I did read some reviews saying that if you had the first iPad, you don't necessarily need to run right out and get iPad 2, because while it is an upgrade, it's not like a gigantic upgrade. And depending on when you bought it, I can't remember when the cutoff date was, but it's about the last month or so. If you purchased an iPad 1, and then like a week later, you discovered that iPad 2 had come out, they will give you $100 off the iPad 2, if you want to try and sell your first one and then take the $100 credit and buy iPad 2, you're welcome to that. So it's going to be interesting.
There was a software update today for the iPad. In fact, mine just finished syncing up a few minutes ago. I'm not really sure what fixes are in there or what exactly it did. There was a list of improvements that it made. But one of the biggest, to me, the biggest negative about the iPad 1 that I'm interested see when Will brings in the new one is the thing is actually kind of heavy. I mean, it's this solid glass, and I mean, it's really a lot heavier than you would expect out of a, especially when I was so used to the Kindle, and the Kindle is so lightweight and so, I mean, just nothing in your hand, and the iPad is, you know, good, probably 2 to 3 times heavier than a Kindle is. And that takes some getting used to. It's balanced real well, but it does seem like if you were to drop this thing, it would just be a major disaster, whereas, you know, the Kindle, sure, you could pick it up and put the back on it or something, and it would keep going, but I would, like, be terrified to drop this iPad. So I'm very interested to see about what they do about it being thinner and lighter, because that is, I guess, the one biggest drawback I see with the iPad 1. But can't wait to see his. He's supposed to bring it by. I'm looking forward to taking a look at it.
Actually, I'll be interested too, because I've got an iPhone 4, iPhone 3, whatever the newest iPhone is, iPhone 4. And, you know, I've dropped that thing to the point where I've actually kind of scratched the supposed unbreakable scratch-proof glass. So I've had some problems with this phone. And it's still doing just fine. And the Kindle, on the other hand, I've already had to have my Kindle replaced. I've got the newest version of the Kindle, and it is much, much lighter and much, much thinner. But one day, I was sitting on the couch, and I dropped it from the couch. And it hit the ground, and I opened it up, and there wasn't like a crack in it, but like the e-ink had run, and there was a giant splotch.
Wow.
And it wouldn't go away, And, you know, I went to the Kindle forums, and apparently this happens to a lot of people, that because they've made it smaller and cheaper, because now they're like $139 if you want it without the Wi-Fi, if you just, or without the 3G, if you just want the Wi-Fi, it's like $139. So they're much smaller and much thinner. And, you know, when I compare the new Kindle to the first Kindle, I mean, the first Kindle, yes, it's a little heavier, it's a little bigger, but my God, that thing seemed a lot sturdier than the new ones.
Yes. I had the first Kindle. I never upgraded my Kindle from the very first one that come out until I got the iPad, and I actually deregistered my original Kindle and gave it to a friend of mine, just gifted it to him. And another person I work with bought one of the $139 Kindles, and that thing, yes, seemed like it was much less sturdy than the one I had. Since the technology is sort of the theme of today's show and everything, we're talking about the iPad and the Kindle. As I was talking to you before we came on, I am having some difficulty with the Kindle app for the iPad. I have one book in particular that keeps crashing the app, and I keep hoping they will. I can't imagine I'm the only person on planet Earth having this problem, and I'm hoping they will upgrade the app or something, but there's been no fix so far. So if anyone listening to this has had a problem with the Kindle app crashing on a book on the iPad and knows a fix for it, shoot me an email over to carlstern.com and give me some heads up, because I'm not getting extraordinarily aggravated with this.
Or in particular, the Road Warrior Animal book, which is the book in question.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I want to say one positive thing about my broken Kindle experience, and that is I called them, I told them what happened, and there was a Kindle on my doorstep the next day. I didn't even have to send my old one back. They just sent out the new one and sent me a box prepaid to send the old one back. It was very easy to get a new one. So that is certainly a positive there.
Yes, I will say this. I don't get anything for hawking Amazon, although I do sell a novel I wrote on Amazon, and I do get some advertising, so full disclosure there. But I have to say, Amazon customer service is, I've been with Amazon many years now, and I will give a thumbs up to their customer service and everything. Well, you know, Brian, I guess the biggest thing we need to talk about is this gigantic earthquake over in Japan last night. I was working and started getting all the news alerts pretty late in the night. I haven't had an opportunity yet to see any of the video footage, but I hear a sight to behold.
Yeah, it is. Last night, I started getting messages from people right around 10 p.m. Pacific. And, you know, at first the messages were like, big earthquake hit, and we're fine. So, you know, we're watching Impact and everything like that, and when the show is over, we were heading up to do the show, and I was briefly watching CNN, and at the time, you know, right before we recorded the show, you know, there was some footage of the wave, you know, wiping out some you know, cars and trucks and that sort of thing. But, you know, at the time, it was like it hit in the north of Japan. It hit an area with lots of farmland. There, at the point, the death toll was only 5. So, you know, we're doing this show, and it's like, man, you know, this is bad news. But, you know, then you wake up this morning, and it's like there are at least 1,000 people probably dead. And then you see all of the footage that has come in, and it's just a complete gigantic disaster. And as we noted last night on the show, I mean, if there's any good news coming out of this, it's the fact that Japan spent many, many years building up their infrastructure to prepare for gigantic earthquakes. And unfortunately, you know, I don't think anybody was preparing for a 9. You know, I think they were preparing for, you know, 7, 7.5, 8, that sort of thing, and this was the big one. But, you know, suffice to say, especially people in Tokyo, I mean, this gigantic earthquake, a 9 earthquake, should have just, you know, leveled cities. But luckily, Tokyo was fine, and things are very, it's a gigantic disaster. But I guess the good news is it certainly could have been worse had they not prepared.
Yes, you know, it's so rare to have an earthquake of this magnitude. I mean, if it's, you know, they still haven't finalized exactly what magnitude this earthquake was, but do you realize that in the entirety of known recorded history, there have only been 10 earthquakes of this magnitude, 8.8 or greater. I mean,
yeah.
In all of recorded history, this is going to be at least one of the top 10 of all time, and that's just incredible. And
well, I hear that too, and I also think that when you think of like the recorded history of earthquakes, I mean, we're largely talking about, you know, the last 100-150 years or so. And over the span of all of history, even just human history, I mean, there's been a lot of gigantic earthquakes. I mean, I was listening last night and, you know, there was an earthquake in, I guess, the late 1600s. And they only know about it because I guess it struck like right around where I'm at right now. And it was so big that Japan got the tsunami. And so Japanese records are talking about this tsunami that hit Japan, and they didn't know why, because, you know, it was so far away that there wasn't like an event that preceded it for them. It was just they were there and suddenly wham, this tsunami hit. So, you know, there have been gigantic earthquakes in the history of the world, but, you know, in the last 100 years, this is like top five.
Oh absolutely. Out of the top 10, the oldest one, you know, that they've assigned a magnitude to was back in 1700. But this is going to be you think about the giant one from 2004 in Indonesia that caused the big tsunami. It was a 9.1. So if this shakes out to be a, you know, an 8.9 or 9.0, I mean, we're talking about essentially the same magnitude earthquake that was. And, you know, famous and greatest earthquakes ever to hit the United States was the New Madrid earthquake that changed the course of the Mississippi River. And of course, I'm 3 hours or so away from the Mississippi River in Memphis, and go that way all the time. Well, a few years ago, I actually had the opportunity to go to the northern part of Tennessee to I believe it's called Real Foot Lake, and that lake was actually created when the Mississippi River changed course and stranded a portion of the river there and created this very shallow lake. And I've actually been to that lake before. So, I mean, and that was nothing of the magnitude, they don't believe, of this earthquake. So that's something else. Definitely, the thoughts definitely go out to those people. I haven't heard anything about the tsunami alerts that went out. I know there were some, but I haven't heard anything about Hawaii or the West Coast or anything like that.
Well, actually, the West Coast, I mean, you know, I was kind of monitoring it last night because my wife's family just bought a condo at Cannon Beach, and it's right on the beach. I mean, it is right there in the sand, and they were there, apparently. They were at Cannon Beach, and so, you know, this morning, I guess, at like 5 a.m., the sirens went off, and it's not even like a siren. It's like a cow mooing is the sound that it makes to alert you to get out of town. And so they got out of town, and as of about 2 hours ago, they were told the coast is clear. And so, you know, there were waves that hit. They were not huge waves. Vinny and I, on our other show last night, were talking about how, you know, if you live in a coastal area and this wave is coming, you know, get to higher ground. Don't go out there and surf. But of course, we turn on the news this morning, and there are, in fact, people surfing the wave in California. And I saw the local news in Cannon Beach, and there are photos of people right there on the beach watching. So there are always going to be people that don't take it too seriously. And thankfully, in these cases, at least, they were small waves that hit the West Coast. But yes, yeah, still tsunami warnings, you know, throughout the Pacific Rim. So it's a big deal. And today, We've talked on this show before about the Global Consciousness Project, which is done out of Princeton. They place these random number generators throughout the world, and they should always generate random numbers, of course. And the theory is that when there are events around the world that globally huge numbers of people are all thinking about at the same time, their theory is that this will affect the eggs. So I went up there this morning just out of curiosity, and I headed up to the Global Consciousness Project site, and they've got a picture up on the front page. Carl, you may be heading up there right now. For those, there's a link on the front page at brianalvarez.com. But basically, it's a 24-hour, I guess it's kind of an animated graphic of the world, and there's a graph in the lower left-hand corner that it should always be even. These random number generators, there are two graphs or two bars, basically, and the little arrows should always be right in the middle because it's a random number generator, of course. If you watch this, at least as of the time I'm recording this, at, I think it's 6:52 UDT, right when the earthquake hit, these eggs go nuts. And wow. I was just fascinated to take a look at this. I mean, right now, I mean, obviously, as time goes by, we're going to lose the actual sight of the graphs going nuts because they're just going to be haywire the entire time. But you could actually track it to the moment the earthquake hit, 5:42, I believe it is, UTC. These graphs just go haywire. So it's fascinating. I have no idea what to make of it.
Me either. And this, again, I brought this up before. And, you know, I'm like you, I don't know what to make of it, but evidence suggests there's something to look at there. So, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to, I mean, aside from some sort of manipulation of it or something, I don't know. I don't know. We've got to definitely see if we can get somebody with a Global Consciousness Project sometime to talk about this. I'd love to know the methodology behind it.
And actually, just as we're recording this update, apparently there is radiation fear at a nuke plant in Japan. I'll read some of this right here. Actually, this is a video. I can't really read it, but I guess there's some tweets here. Radiation levels, this is from Helen Cook at Reuters. Radiation levels in Fukushima Daiichi plant, central control unit, 1,000 times normal. So obviously, that is not good, but that is of the time that I'm recording this segment with Carl. So I guess just check out the news for more on that. There's a earth crust rupture 150 miles long, 50 miles wide. There's a cruise ship and an entire train missing. Over 1,000 feared dead. North American plate snapped upwards. It's a huge deal. So we'll continue following this the best we can. But that's pretty much all I know about it right now as we speak. Carl, the website, we've got a lot of stuff on it right now, including a story about humans and apes having similar aging patterns. Wanted to bring this up. I'm not exactly sure. I guess that's the point of science. It's, you know, you investigate things that people take for granted and you try to find out whether or not they are actually the case. I would presume that humans and apes would have similar aging patterns. But the interesting thing about it is they have a definition here in the story of what aging is, and they define it as the increasing likelihood of dying of natural causes. And we've talked a lot in the past about, you know, science is looking at ways to remove this likelihood of dying of natural causes or slowly try to eliminate these things, which I guess in some ways they feel would help stop aging.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the biggest, I think, scientific fields of interest in the coming, probably next 20, 25 years. You know, there are a lot of, as we discover more and more about, you know, even things like vitamins and supplements, and of course, as we get more and more into mapping the genes and chromosomes and things like that, aging is, I mean, the ultimate goal of all this is to slow down, stop, or reverse even the aging process. Now, that brings up some amazing philosophical and moral issues as well, but I really think it's going to be one of those fields that greatly expands in the coming couple of decades.
One other thing I wanted to make sure that we talked about here, this was put up, we haven't done a show in a couple of weeks here, but a couple of interesting stories. There was a NASA scientist, Richard Hoover, who believed he had found fossilized bacterium in a meteorite, and he was challenging the larger scientific community to investigate his findings, which is, of course, what you do in science. And apparently, at this point, the larger scientific community has determined, or at least they believe, that he has not, in fact, found alien life. The meteorite, apparently, it is not a fresh meteorite, so to speak. It has been It has been around for 30 or 40 years, I believe, and they believe it has been contaminated by life on Earth, essentially. And it was certainly interesting, but looks like probably not what Hoover was expecting it to be.
Well, you know, this kind of links back to the meteorite that was found, I guess a decade or so ago, that when Clinton was president, they made the big announcement that, there had been evidence of this Martian meteorite containing, traces of fossilized bacteria and stuff. And, you know, as time went by, they really backed down off of that, too. So I'm thinking there is, and looking at the photos of both of them, they look extraordinarily similar to me. Of course, I'm not educated to know the difference, but they, just a layman looking at them, look like the same thing to me. So I think maybe there's some sort of geological process going on there. I've really moved away from the whole bacterial Martian thing for a long time ago. And then when this popped up, it was essentially the same sort of deal. There is one thing I wanted to mention that's also up on the site, and that is really one of my, areas of interest, and that is the theory of everything. The string theory is that scientists are starting to question whether there's anything there, whether they should, this is going to be a provable thing. And it's just a link to a great article. People who are interested in things like extra dimensions and string theory and quantum physics and stuff need to definitely check that out, because it's extraordinarily complicated field of research, but it also opens and closes the door to a lot of things, a lot of possible supernatural things that we have for the history of humanity. Many people have attributed to supernatural could be explained by string theory and extra dimensions and things like that. And now scientists are really starting to question whether this is provable, whether it's exists or not. And so anyone interested in that field needs to definitely check that article out.
What I thought was interesting about the article is not just the questioning of string theory, but the questioning of whether a theory of everything can actually ever be discovered. Is there even such a thing, is now the question. And of course Einstein was searching for it when he died, and Michio Kaku, of course, is a huge proponent. I guess I don't know if you could call him the founder of string theory. I forget exactly how he prefers to be identified, but certainly he's one of the biggest proponents of all of string theory. And not just a question of whether that theory is correct, but whether there is a correct theory. Is there even a theory of everything? And
there's definitely much more to learn. Now, how did we forget to mention this? We've been off for a couple of weeks. Zahi Hawass apparently whacked.
I did not hear this.
Yes, apparently, and amongst all the Egyptian turmoil, he has been no longer the Egyptian Antiquities Director or whatever his official title
is. Really?
I believe this came out in the news maybe 3 or 4 days ago. And, of course, I can't just run up here on Google News and type in Zahi Hawass, because I have no earthly idea how to begin to even spell that, but... here we go. It's trying to see what day it...
I've actually got it right here.
Yeah.
Egypt's chief antiquities official Zahi Hawass has confirmed his resignation late this week from his post amid political turmoil and the looting of antiquities. He's well known for his role in archaeological investigations and overseas exhibitions, appearing in documentaries, and recently concluding an agreement with New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art to return artifacts to his country. He has headed Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities for about a decade. Some controversy has swirled in the Western press over his resignation. In a note emailed to USA Today on Saturday, he confirmed his resignation, and they have some excerpts from his note. He's very upset about the protests, very upset about the crooks in the ministry and at the University of Cairo who are attacking him personally. And there are not enough police to protect the site. He said, at 63, I do not have concrete plans for the future. I am still thinking about what I should do. How about that? That needs to go up on our front page right now, actually.
Yeah, no doubt. Too bad, Zahi. Not one of my favorite and most personal people in the world, but
I've heard that, yes.
So you know, maybe now, of course, you know, that. Who knows how all that's going to shake out. He may be back in there next week, or I don't see a more liberal director coming in there that opens up, you know, the pyramids and so forth for more alternate theories to be researched and so forth. I certainly don't think they'll swing a more liberal direction in that, but as long as he was in there, you know, you knew what you were going to get. So any change may be at least some good change.
I always hate hearing of antiquities looted.
Yes, oh, absolutely. From all the way back in the library at Alexandria, all the way through human history, people have destroyed that sort of stuff, and just how much knowledge have we lost? And gosh, I mean, yeah. As soon as all the rioting broke out in Egypt, that was the first thing I thought of was, you know, oh my God, there's going to be so much potential for destruction of history here. And sure enough, there was apparently some.
Before we go, I wanted to make sure I got your thoughts, if you have any, on something I posted on the front page a couple days ago. Around, it's called Sasquatch the Quest, the Erickson Project. It is the talk of the Bigfoot community of late, and supposedly it is a documentary that is in the works, and they're making a lot of claims, including that in this documentary you will see full facial footage of a Sasquatch. And I'm always skeptical of these sorts of deals, because to me, if you've made a breakthrough and you have discovered strong evidence of a Sasquatch, I mean, to me, you go immediately to the scientific community as opposed to just creating a documentary about it.
Yes, exactly. That's the whole peer review process, you know. Put it in some scientific journal and have it peer reviewed. Of course, at the same time, that would be the scientific way to do it. The money-making way to do it would be put together a documentary. So, you know, who am I?
Well, yeah. They're basically claiming that the footage that they have of Sasquatch is better than the Patterson footage. And I just have to say that whether you believe that the Patterson footage was an actual Sasquatch or a man in a suit, regardless of which of those two you believe, what cannot be denied is it's very, very good, clear footage. What it is good, clear footage of, it's up to you to decide. But it's very, very clear. So the idea that they have footage that just completely trumps the Patterson footage, I mean, this I will have to see.
Yes, and again, you know, I'm extremely skeptical that that suddenly this is just, you know, now coming out and they've kept this under wraps. You would think that would definitely leak somewhere, somehow, but I suppose we'll see. I will definitely be looking forward to putting that on the DVR. Well, I'm real interested here in the interview today. I love Crunch Gear website, crunchgear.com. It's one of my regular stops on the internet, so for people who are not familiar with it, definitely bookmark that site. They have lots and lots of cool stuff on there. And they've got some iPad stuff on there, too, so if you're interested in that, the new one, check that out, too.
That is coming up next, and Carl, get some plugs out there.
Well, carlstern.com, that'll pretty much get you everything you need to know, and, of course, over at wrestlingobserver.com, I do a show over there, so I'm told, and it's pretty good, I like to think.
So he's told. Check it out. CarlStern.com, WrestlingObserver.com. Want to thank Carl as always. We'll be back in just a moment with Nicholas DeLeon, CrunchGear.com. We're going to be talking technology here at After Dark Radio at BrianAlvarez.com. We are back here on the show. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio, BrianAlvarez.com. Joined today by Nicholas DeLeon, whose name I already screwed up, from CrunchGear.com, here to talk technology. And Nicholas, how you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
Not too bad. We first got acquainted because you apparently were there for a lot of the Watson stuff, the press conference for the Watson computer that went on to defeat two human beings at Jeopardy. And yes. Tell us a little bit about that story.
I write for CrunchGear. It's a tech site. It's part of the TechCrunch, I guess, sort of empire, if you will. And IBM invited a bunch of journalists and writers and so forth to their big research facility in New York. It's about maybe half an hour north of the city, north of New York City. And they had like a dry run, so to speak, of Watson against Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter. And what it was it was like a little theater, and they gathered all the journalists, and they said, okay, guys, here we go. It was pretty much it. They should have just like threw us into it. And I was there sort of live blogging the whole situation, giving sort of a play-by-play of what was going on. And it was funny because the guy, the IBM engineer, he's like trying to downplay. He's like, that took a long time to create. We don't really know, how it's going to do in this live setting, so we'll see how it goes. And lo and behold, Alex Trebek asked the first question, and bam, Watson answered it in a split second. And the whole room, it was like when you first saw like man walking on the moon, like, oh my God, this is a big thing.
Yeah.
The whole room was like, wow, this is happening. This is happening was the reaction. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, we've talked about this on the show before, but I remember when I watched it, when I watched all of the episodes, and when you first see this monitor in between these two people, and Alex Trebek is asking questions, and the computer is beating these guys.
Right.
And beating them in the form of a question, obviously. It's not just like, it's not just like Googling something and getting an answer.
Right,
it's far more complex, and you're just like, oh my God, look at this. And then after a while, I was just kind of like, yeah, this is really cool, but this computer doesn't remind me in any way of a human. Like some of the things that it said, it's like, it was funny, but it didn't know it was being funny. You know what I mean? It was just like, it was a really super, super fast computer, but I didn't really feel like I was watching like the beginning of a real breakthrough in intelligence.
Right. It wasn't, people were like, oh my God, Watson is going to win Jeopardy. Then he's going to take over. It's like, no, that's not anywhere near close to happening. IBM was very specific when they said, as advanced, it took them 4 years to create, and as much hardware and everything that it requires to get the whole thing up and running, these are just baby steps. Like, they gave us a whole bunch of facts about comparing the human brain to Watson, and the difference is it's laughable. Like, the raw capability of the human brain versus Watson, it's cartoonish how underpowered Watson is. And despite all that, they were still able to create the program that would have able to beat them in Jeopardy. So people were discounting, like, oh, it's just Watson. But, I mean, you have to recognize it took them 4 years to make it do that.
Yeah.
And a lot of computing power. So there's a lot going on, but it's not Skynet. Let's not, make it seem like it's something else.
Now, I don't know if you heard the show that we did on the singularity, and whether you did or not, I wanted to get your opinion on, obviously everybody knows about computing power, and it doubles every 2 years,
right.
Or I think it's actually sped up now, it's actually doubling faster than that, but, are we going to reach the point where Moore's Law breaks down? Are we going to, because there are arguments that, okay, by 2020, Moore's Law is going to break down. These computers are no longer going to be doubling in power every 2 years. It's just not going to be possible anymore. And then there are other people that say, well, you're looking at it in terms of the technology that we have now. And
right,
in the next
exactly.
5-6 years, we're going to have a new technology that will allow us to continue doubling. Where do you fall in this?
It's hard to underestimate technology. I mean, like 5 years ago, we didn't have an iPhone, and now everyone has an iPhone, which is more powerful than the desktop computer you had, 10 years ago. So by 2020, who's to say that it can't keep doubling or there'll be some sort of breakthrough in quantum computing where it's like not only have we doubled it, we're way, you know, it's a whole new revolution. So it's hard to say. I find it really hard to say, well, this is it. We can't double it anymore. We're done. It doesn't seem to work that way. So I'm more of, I guess, optimistic would be the word to use. I'm not so quick to say, you know, that's it. We're done. So
now, Ray Kurzweil believes that 2029 is the year that a computer and a human brain will be indistinguishable. So I don't know how they would do the big test. You put a man in a box and a computer in a box or something like that. But, you know, you wouldn't be able to tell if you were talking to a computer or a man, and you could talk about anything and this and that. And what is your opinion on that? Is this looking way too, is 2029 a ridiculous number, or
I mean, 20, that's what, 20 years from now? That's a long time. In this.
Sure.
I mean, they made Watson in 4 years using technology that was, you know, of 4 years ago and prior. So, I mean, 20 years from now, it is very hard to say that, it's hard to say anything, really, about 20 years from now. I know that's sort of like a cop-out answer.
But it's true.
But it's just so insane. So I don't even know how to answer that. I mean, he could well be right. I mean, like, Ray is very much of that camp. Like, I've heard that interview and others where he's definitely, like, I guess the word would be optimist. Like, he really believes this is going to happen. And I don't see any reason why it couldn't. I mean, again, 20 years, who even knows what's going to happen? So I understand that's a terrible answer for anyone trying to listen for any sort of insight. But it's just, you just can't predict. I really don't think you can predict.
I always think back to, like, when I was in high school, and we didn't have cell phones. Like, today, kids, they go to school, and they got their cell phones. You know, when I was, like, in junior high, middle school, I had a pager. And this was 15, 20 years ago, something like that. About 20 years ago. I was about 15, so 20 years ago. I had a pager. And when you look at, like, an iPhone today, I mean, obviously, an iPhone is so much more advanced than a pager that it's not even funny. However, yeah, when you look at the path from the pager to the iPhone, you know, a few years after the pager, we had kids, you know, started bringing cell phones to school. I was like at the very, very tail end, where when I was about to graduate from high school, there might have been a couple of kids with these big, bulky cell phones. And then from there, it's like, when you look at the path, it was not like a linear path, because a phone today, I think for a lot of people, when their phone rings, it's like, oh, God, I'm getting a call. You know, it's not about the phone anymore.
No, it's not. Well, so many people don't use, let's say their iPhone as a phone.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's like, what? It's ringing. What is that new feature? Like, it's
sure,
just a computer. It went from being, you know, a pager to a phone where, you know, people use it as a phone, and then now it is a computer in your hands. I mean, there's no way around it.
Yeah. So, I mean, where do you see, I mean, again, it's hard to predict the future, but when you look at what mobile phones were 15 years ago, you know, these giant things that you put in your car if you were, like, rich.
Right.
And now everyone's got an iPhone or a Droid or whatever the case might be. I mean, where do you see this going in the next, let's just say, 5 years? It's a little easier.
It's probably reached a point where, like, for a long time it was going to be, oh, they're going to be smaller, they're going to be thinner. I mean, this is, if you hold a phone in your hand, like a Droid or whatever, that's pretty much the optimal. I mean, it's not heavy, it's not big, the screen resolution is very sharp. So we're at the point where the actual hardware is pretty good for most people's day-to-day uses. And these phones, I mean, they're not designed, you know, for hugely computing necessary, you know, they're for your everyday thing. You tweet, you look up restaurants. So as it stands, they're pretty good. But in the next 5 years, I mean, it would probably be more developments on the software side of things, just to make it. And a big push now is to make these things more social. Like there's new apps like every 2 minutes saying like, oh, your friends are eating, do you want to go there? Like,
sure,
location-based services, things like that. So they're trying to use the hardware as it exists, because it's already at a pretty decent position right now for the average person's use. And to push the software to see what can we do with this? How can we use maybe the GPS in a interesting way? How can we use a camera in a new innovative way. So now it seems to be trying to make use of what we have more than to create, you know, oh, now there's an iPhone. We're at that point. We have the phone. Now it's more like, what can we do with it?
Sure.
That's how I see things are going.
Now, today is the day that iPad 2 comes out. And,
yes.
I mean, I really want an iPad 2. I have friends that have them. I've used them. This one is even thinner. But, and this is kind of one of the things that people said when the first iPad came out. They were like, what do you really need this for? You know, you've got a laptop.
Right,
you've got a phone. What do you really need an iPad for? Yeah, that did not deter millions.
I was and still sort of am on that boat, I guess. I personally have zero need for an iPad. Like, I don't need it in my life. I have my laptop. I have my big, you know, gaming computer with the huge graphics card and all that. So I really don't need an iPad in my life. But it seems that a lot of people do.
Sure.
Well, it seems like they don't, but they
feel like they do, even though they probably know that they don't, but they still want it, if that makes any sense.
Right. I remember I actually interviewed Chuck Liddell about a year ago, and he was showing off his iPad. It was some event, and he was like looking at Netflix movies on his iPad. I was like, oh, so is that what you use it for? He's like, yeah, it does Netflix pretty good. So I guess he needs it to be able to watch Netflix, you know, wherever he is. So people find uses for it, and I don't know if the average person needs it, but it certainly seems like it's definitely the cool thing to have right now. I think people, once they get it, they find things to do with it, is how it is. Because I don't see how a Brian Alvarez would need an iPad in his life.
Mostly just to read things, but it's like,
yeah.
I could do that on one of any of the computers in this house. I've got a Kindle, for example. I think one of the things with the iPad, and really any of these tablets, is it seems so high-tech, you know? Like, anyone who's over the age of, I don't know, 25, you know, you came up reading books, you read textbooks
right.
in school, you read this and that, and you know, maybe you watch some science fiction movies, and there's all this wacky technology. And here's the idea of, like, you know, this really thin tablet that, like, it's full color and you can watch video and you can read. It just seems so cool to have a tablet. It seems cooler than having a laptop, even though you can do so much more stuff with a laptop.
Right. And if you're just out to look, you know, if you just need to use Twitter on the street or you need to find a restaurant, we all have phones and they all do that quite well. So there's no real reason to also bring an iPad, which doesn't necessarily fit in your pockets, you know, that sort of thing. It's a weird in-between device. I mean, some people are thinking maybe it'll actually one day replace your laptop. They'll get to a point where they're actually powerful enough and so forth where you won't need a laptop. But I don't know if we're at that point yet. I mean, they still seem not toys, but they still seem like something that you don't necessarily, that you can live without, I guess you could say.
Sure. But that has not stopped tons of people from buying
those. Oh, no. It's they sold millions last time. I'm sure I'd be shocked if they don't sell out this weekend of all the iPads. So, I mean, the Apple has a hit, as they do, but it's still definitely like that in-between device. And the other interesting thing is there was a report yesterday, I think it was J.P. Morgan, who said that all these other tablets, I mean, we've got the iPad over here, and then all the other tablets. Essentially, he said, no one's going to buy these other tablets. I mean, people are buying the iPad because it's the iPad. Nobody wants the Android tablet from Motorola, even though they're comparable in their, you know, their specs and what they do and what you use them for. It is the idea of having an iPad that seems to be the most attractive thing about the device.
Well, I read a lot of other reviews where people were noting things like, you know, there are drawbacks, and I'm sure that there are people listening right now that are just, their smoke is coming out their ears that we're promoting the iPad here, but...
Oh, I don't have one. I'm pretty safe to say I'll never buy one, so I'm not like an iPad mark, if you will.
Sure, but, you know, all of these reviews, I mean, many of them are pointing out the same thing that, you know, these iPads, you there's no flash, you
right.
know, the camera sucks, and this and that. But they're also making the point, which actually, you know, I feel is somewhat of a valid point. We're already at the iPad 2, when a lot of these other tablets, it's their first generation. So
yeah,
Apple,
and the rumor is, in the fall, Apple will release the iPad 3, which will make the iPad 2 look like, you know, a hunk of junk. So everyone else is definitely playing catch-up, and it's going to be weird for them to catch up.
Let me ask you this question, because somebody asked on the board, and I mean, I could argue for and against this theory, but I wanted your thought on this. I'll actually just, I'll read his question, and then I'll give you my thoughts on this here. He says, let's see here. It's probably safe to say that your IBMs and Intels of the world are working on stuff that makes currently available commercial tech look like nothing. But I'm not sure if there's any secretive reason why they don't get released sooner. This person is basically saying, you know, do they hold off on technology to make sure that a year from now you buy the new technology? And I don't know. I can see an argument for that. I'll get your thoughts here. But at the same time, it's like in a competitive field, it's almost like if you've got this technology that blows away what you're selling right now, I mean, what are the chances that you have it and nobody else is working on something similar, and they're just going to scoop you if you hold it up?
Right. Well, a lot of I know like companies like IBM and Intel, and all those type of companies, they are definitely working on stuff that, you know, would make the things we have available today just, you know, look like junk. But a lot of the problem is, can they affordably release that? I mean, yeah, they can produce, let's say, a CPU that runs at, you know, 10 megahertz or 10 gigahertz, but it's so expensive to produce, there's no way they can release it. So a lot of it is cost, and a lot of it is, as far as, like, getting an advantage on your competitor, I don't know. The question, like, I saw that question on the board, it seemed very conspiratorial, and I think it's probably a lot more prosaic reason why, if they're working on these really advanced things, that they don't get released, and it's probably just too expensive to release, or there's no real reason to release it. Because I know, like, the graphics card companies, NVIDIA and AMD, like, every year they release these super powerful graphics cards that cost hundreds of dollars. And I have one of these. But there's no game on planet Earth that requires that sort of power. So you're releasing something for an audience that can't even really use the hardware.
And by the time there is a game,
why would you release something if no one can even take advantage of it?
Sure,
and
by the time
it's going to be expensive, and there's no place for it yet.
By the time that game is available, that card will be cheaper as well.
Oh,
correct?
Yeah, and it probably won't even be in stores anymore by the time that game is available.
Yeah, so, I always think, like, you know, what would be the purpose of Apple having essentially like the iPad 6 already ready to go, but they're holding off on it? Because
these things take so long to research. I don't think, you know, iPad 6. Now, they're probably well on their way with the iPad 3. I mean,
sure.
Particularly if the rumors hold true that it'll be released in the fall. But these things, they don't come up overnight. It takes a lot of time to create something like that. So,
plus, again,
I don't know if you know, some sort of secretive agreement is preventing the release of X, Y, and Z.
Sure. And I also think that, like we were talking about with the pager to the iPhone path, I mean, you never know what your audience is going to want.
Right.
You know, if you've got six more versions of the iPad all ready to go, and you're just going to release them every 6 months or every year or something like that, I mean, okay, so 6 years from now, you think you know what people are going to want in iPad there's, 6? Of course not.
No, there's no way. There's no way. That, I mean, at most, maybe 2 years, you could reliably say, okay, we'll still be using an iPad-like device in the next 2 or 3 years. But to say, you know, 5 years, we'll certainly be... No. I mean, it just changes so quickly, particularly tablets, which pretty much were not invented by the iPad, but they really entered, like, the public consciousness only last year. I mean, prior to the iPad, nobody really was speaking about tablets. Everyone was talking about netbooks, small laptops. And then... Now netbooks are completely irrelevant, and we're all talking about tablets. So it's sort of you can't look too far ahead and anticipate that people will keep using the same type of thing in the future that they're using today.
Especially
it's so odd like that.
Yeah, I think back to, you know, it's like I got the first iPhone I got was iPhone 3, then I got an iPhone 4, and it's been like, I don't know, a year, maybe a year and a half, and it's a very short period of time in a person's life, but then you think back and you're like, man, can I remember a time before I had an iPhone-like device? You know, you think back to, I mean, what phone? I can't even remember what phone I had in 2005, but guaranteed it sucked. But at the time, it was like, man, you know, this huge phone the size of a pocketbook that I can text on. Yes. So, you know, looking 5 years from now, I mean, I guess that brings me to this question, because there are two things that I'm really fascinated by as far as technology. And again, two things I have no use for, but I'd still want.
Right.
One of them is I want to talk to you about 3D, because 3D is like the new big thing with a lot of people. I've always found 3D to be really stupid. And the reason for that is because you have to wear those damn glasses. Right. It's always like anything, I feel like any technology where you have to wear something or have something special to make it work, it's kind of like a technology that's not going to last all that long. But I have heard that they are working on televisions that if you're sitting in the right spot, which hopefully would be a rather large area you could sit in front of it if you have friends over, but you will be able to have a 3D television with 3D programming without glasses.
Yeah, I've seen it. Every January, there's a show called the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. It's like a big convention where all the giant companies of the world, Microsoft, Sony, etc., they come, they show their new stuff for the year, you know, yada yada. And in one of these behind-the-scenes meetings, I actually saw, I believe it was Toshiba was the company. And yeah, they had a TV. It was a standard-sized TV, let's say 40 inches, and it was 3D without glasses. There was definitely like a line of sight, so to speak, that you couldn't move too far to the left or to the right, but you were you know, a good distance away, like where your couch would be in relation to the TV, and it was 3D. It doesn't, these 3D TVs, they don't look like Avatar. Like, a lot of people like to compare, oh, it's like Avatar. Avatar is so, like, was so perfected for 3D to even suggest that you're going to be able to watch 2.5 Men in 3D one day and have it be such an engrossing experience as the first time you saw Avatar. It's just completely not going to happen. But the technology is in development, and I did see it, and it did work. So it is definitely on the way.
Well, when you say not going to happen, I mean, what about in 10 years?
In 10 years? Oh, yeah, I guess you could say that. In 10 years, maybe. But 3D, to me, it seems more gimmicky than anything else. I remember I was at some conference one day where one of the ESPN high-up guys was saying how difficult a time they were having in filming sporting events in 3D. They couldn't see how they could do it affordably, and they were saying it's going to be a lot more growing pains transitioning into 3D than it was to transition into HD. So it might happen, but it's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be as quick or as seamless a transition as it was from standard def TV to HD TV. But yeah, like you said, you can't really say it'll never happen.
What are your thoughts on this? Because I was thinking about this a little bit in terms of online piracy. And, you know, one of the reasons that people pirate a lot of things is because, you know, if you're okay with watching something on the internet as opposed to on your television, then you know, there's a growing generation right now that if they can get it for free, they'd rather get it for free than pay for it. But,
right.
You know, with UFC, for example, one of the reasons, and obviously there's still a lot of piracy for UFC, more than WWE, for example, but you're also looking at something where way more people are interested in UFC pay-per-views WWE pay-per-views. But if let's just say that I'm a person that pirates UFC events. Okay, if I'm going to have a bunch of friends over to watch UFC, they're all going to want to watch it on a 58-inch screen in high def. They're not going to want me to plug the computer or plug the laptop into the HD slot and watch a feed that probably isn't going to be HD and really doesn't look all that good. So if I have friends over, I'm going to actually buy the pay-per-view. Now, I've always kind of thought that if piracy gets to be this issue, you know, there's only so much bandwidth on the internet, as far as I'm aware. I mean, you know, if 3D starts to really catch on big, I mean, the idea of being able to pirate an event in 3D, it's going to be very difficult, I would think. Far more difficult than just pirating your regular television show. So there might be that incentive to move to 3D, because that gives the people incentive to not pirate stuff, because they're, you know, they can't see in 3D if they do that.
Yeah, that's a valid point. I mean, you would need, I mean, the amount of people who have 3D TVs right now, I mean, again, we're only talking about right now, but it very, very few. I mean, there was a study a couple months ago, where they said that essentially nobody has a 3D TV yet. So we're a long way away from where Dana White can say, why would you pirate this? It's in 3D. It's like, because, well, nobody has a 3D TV.
Sure.
But at the same time, you can't really rely, he and UFC and WWE, they can't rely on it being the experience that it is today, where it is like you have, let's say, like a, you know, like a Justin.TV stream where the image freezes up every so often. And it just doesn't look good. You can't expect it to always be like that. I mean, maybe in 10 years there'll be, you know, Justin TV Plus where it legitimately looks. I mean, YouTube videos right now, they can get up into 1080p resolution. So, I mean, the tech exists. Whether or not you could stream that type of fidelity right now, I mean, that's just a matter of time. So you're right. I mean, he could say, why would you pirate it if it's in 3D? I mean, a lot of people will still pirate it anyway.
Well, sure,
answer.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're going to probably have to try to, well, yeah, they're going to have to figure that out. I mean, maybe they'll, and they're trying as it is. I mean, I wrote a story maybe a month or two ago where they inked a deal with some like web streaming company where if you order UFC internet pay-per-view, which is, I think it was $50, pretty much the same price as you'd pay to watch it on your TV, but you get the live stream and there's some interactive features. They give you multiple camera angles that you can use, you know, at your leisure. They give you separate audience language tracks. They give you a chat room, and you know that. So they're trying to make the experience more than just the raw, you know, video feed of watching the fight. They're trying to make it more of a value add-on type of thing. So they are trying to fight this in ways other than just with lawsuits.
All right, let me ask you this so then. Far. When you mention that, that process right there, I mean, do you sort of feel that in order to stay ahead of pirates, I mean, obviously you've got to keep ahead in technology and that sort of thing, but would the key to fighting internet piracy as far as like television be that ultimately someday you're going to have to produce something similar to what UFC is doing in the sense that the user can interface with what they are watching in a very individual way. So basically, you know, if you're watching a stream with 50,000 other people, you're at the mercy of what the one guy streaming it wants to do. If he wants to watch it at a certain angle, well, you're screwed. You've got to watch it at that angle. Whereas if you create a viewing experience where you can control all aspects of what you're watching, then that's value to you as a consumer.
Yeah, and they and other companies will probably have to do something like that to ensure that people won't just be satisfied with, you know, the raw image. I mean, like Blu-rays and DVDs, they come with all these special features. I mean, special features started on DVDs to get people to buy the DVD instead of just buying the old videotape. And the same thing with Blu-ray. They tried to add more like network connectivity they're trying to build an experience around the base product. And that's an experience that can't necessarily be pirated. And that is really the only way that they've sort of thought that they could fight this. I mean, it's difficult to fight piracy just because a lot of these guys, they're based in, you know, in other countries where UFC really doesn't have any sort of jurisdiction or can't really go after them very easily, so they're going to have to like create things around the actual just watching, you know, the main event to entice people to continue to pay. And it's really weird because like Dave Meltzer, he always writes in the Observer that UFC is one like pretty much 100% dependent upon pay-per-view revenue. So if they don't figure this out, they could stand to, you know, be hurt by this more so than say WWE, which has, you know, all these other revenue streams. So if anyone is going to figure out piracy, I actually think it's going to be UFC because they stand to lose the most out of really all of, let's say, Hollywood, out of like content producers. Their whole livelihood is dependent upon that pay-per-view revenues. And if anyone's going to figure this out, it's probably going to be them. So what they do will definitely set some sort of a trend, I guess you could say.
So basically, if you want to fight piracy, the question you need to ask is, what part of this experience cannot be pirated? So,
yeah.
For example, in movies, when people are like, you know, movies are going to die because of piracy, it's always like, no, there's always going to be people that want on Friday and Saturday night to go to a movie with their friends or with their girlfriend or whatever. So that's, you know, that's always going to prop it up at least to a degree. And you know, with anything else, it's like, you know, with the music industry. What part of buying this CD or being a fan of this band, I guess is best, cannot be pirated? Well, the live experience, going and seeing them in concert or whatever. So, I mean, I think that what UFC is doing is actually a pretty smart idea if they can get it to take off. The idea that you, when you pay your money, you have full interactive control of what you are viewing.
And not only that, but the stream quality, it looks great. Like compared, I'm sure you've seen, you know, like UFC streams from all these crazy websites. A lot of the time, they just look terrible. Whereas if you pay your $50 for the UFC stream, it looks fantastic, and you get all these, you know, bells and whistles on top of that. So they're definitely trying to figure this out. And if I had to bet, I would say that they would, because again, their whole future depends on it. So
the other thing I wanted to ask about that I've always been fascinated by is TVs, and really anything. The iPad is an example as well, but things getting thinner and thinner. I was under the impression that at some point in the near future, and perhaps the very near future, they will have the technology to create a TV that basically you can roll up like a poster, and then you unroll it and you can put it anywhere in your house, you know, put it on the wall, put it wherever the case might be. Is it really that close to happening?
Well, I haven't seen that technology in a behind the scenes room at CES, but I have read about exactly that, like screens that are just, you know, paper like that you could just roll up and put wherever. So the idea exists, but I don't think that's anywhere near going to be at your local Best Buy or whatever anytime soon. I mean, TVs right now, they're thin enough where you can hang them on your wall and not really notice them. So at a certain point, there's no real incentive to make it that much thinner. I mean, it's all screen. There's no big bezel as there was in the old days. It's all glass. So they've definitely reached almost like a plateau with TV technology, which is why a lot of people think that there was this huge and pretty much out of nowhere push for 3D. Because it's like, okay, we've got the TV, the HDTV, and that is it. That is as much as we can do with an HDTV. How are we going to make money again? Oh, I know. Let's make 3D TV, and we'll start the whole cycle again. So maybe it's definitely something that, you know, you read in crazy physics books that this technology works in labs, maybe, but not, you're not going to be able to buy that. I don't think. I've never seen it anytime soon.
I'm talking to you on a landline right now, and I've always been interested in how different technologies advance at faster rates than other technologies. Obviously, we talked about going from a pager to an iPhone, and we're talking about, you know, going from a cathode ray tube TV to these super thin TVs that you hang on your wall. But at the same time, the landline that I'm talking to you on, you sound like you're on a phone. Like, if I called you 30 years ago, it probably would sound largely the same as it sounds right now. And, you know, obviously people are experimenting with Skype and that sort of thing.
Right.
But there is no huge rush to fix the sound quality of a telephone. So I figure that, like, you know, in 30 years, if people still have landlines, it's going to sound exactly the same as it sounds right now. So my question is, are there certain areas of technology that you feel are slowing down, and other areas of technology that you see in the next 10 years we should keep our eyes on because they're going to explode?
Well, probably the thing that'll be developing the fastest will definitely be these mobile things, like your iPhones, your Androids, your iPads, your tablets. Anything mobile is pretty much where all the energies of these companies are going. As far as things slowing down, I guess to bring like a gaming reference, the Xbox 360 has been around since, I think it came out in fall 2000, what was it, 5. So we're coming on, you know, like 6 years, which is a very long time in gaming terms. And that seems to be something that's slowing down, like the console release cycle. You're not going to be seeing an Xbox 362 as quickly as you may have seen in the past. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to develop like Wii, you know, Nintendo Wii, like controls called the Kinect. Sony has one called the Move. They're trying to basically squeeze as much life out of these boxes as humanly possible before they have to release a new piece of hardware. So I think that's, as far as like consumer tech goes, I would say, I guess your home video game console seems to have slowed down probably more than anything I've seen in some times. And on the flip side, like I said, anything mobile is just moving at such, it's such a ridiculous thing, because people like ask me like, oh, well, what's the good Android phone to get? It's like, I'll give you an answer today, but literally a month from now, it'll be a different answer, and there'll be a different, better phone. That's how quick it is. So that's that.
Tell us a little bit about the Roku. I was actually going to buy one prior to the last ROH pay-per-view on GoFightLive.tv, but unfortunately, the GoFightLive events are not streaming on the Roku Live yet, and so I'm going to wait until that happens before I grab one. But tell everybody what it is, and do you see this as something that is, you know, sometimes you see a technology that it's going to catch on at some point. It may be slow, but eventually it will. Or is it something that, you know, it's cool now, but with all of the other technology and the fact that you can plug your iPad into your TV and everything else that's coming up, it's going to kind of be there for a while and then slowly just kind of fade away?
Well, I guess to start, Roku, it's a small little set-top box that you put next to your TV. It doesn't have, like, a hard drive or anything on there. What it does is it streams video from, like, your home network or from the Internet to your TV. It's sort of like a go-between between some sort of storage, either on the Internet or on your local home, to your TV. And what it is, they've set up deals with a bunch of companies like Netflix. UFC actually has a deal with them, MLB, where, you know, the idea is that you could almost, like, get rid of your cable, you know, no longer subscribe to DirecTV or cable television because, oh, you have this device, and it replaces the need for an ESPN if you have MLB.TV streaming to your TV, you know, 24/7. It actually picked up a lot more steam than I ever thought it would, because it's sort of like a geeky device, if you will. But I've heard, like, you know, quote-unquote normal people, you know, oh, this Roku thing is pretty neat. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's pretty much a dead simple way to watch Netflix on your TV. And Netflix really pretty much came out of nowhere with the streaming thing, but it really blew up really quickly with this whole streaming technology. So Roku is one box of, I mean, it's not the only box that does that. Apple has one called the Apple TV where it'll stream, like, iTunes content. There's one called Boxy Box, which does much the same thing. The whole point of these devices is just to stream video to your TV, and so you don't have to have, you know, you don't have to plug your laptop into your TV, or you don't have to have a giant collection of DVDs, you know, on your counter or whatever. You could just stream video from Netflix or whatever provider to your TV on demand, and everything is great. I mean, that's the idea. How far, you know, a lot of that depends on there was actually a story the other day where a lot of Hollywood executives are sort of getting scared of Netflix and services like that, because they're used to making money off DVDs, they're used to making money off of licensing to, like, channels like HBO and so forth, but HBO is not going to pay you X amount of money for the rights to some movie if it's already on Netflix and everyone can just stream it on demand. So they're sort of, Netflix and Roku, these things are going to, they're going to be interesting to watch these things in the next, let's say, year or maybe two, because a lot of their success is completely dependent upon whether or not the Hollywood movie studios and so forth, whether or not they play ball, so to speak. So, I mean, a lot of their success is just completely out of their hands, which is sort of scary if you're one of those guys.
I usually am too busy to watch any movies, so I've actually never used Netflix and never used a Roku. My question is, I've got Comcast cable and Showtime and HD, for example. I think in Comcast, it's still only 1080i. And I think Verizon Fios will do 1080p, and I think maybe DirecTV as well. I'm not positive on this. If I'm wrong, you can correct me. But Netflix and Roku, when they stream, for example, MLB.TV, How does the streaming compare to an actual HD broadcast?
Well, I've never seen MLB TV. I've seen regular Netflix, like a regular movie you would watch, and it really doesn't compare. Like I set it up for my father at Christmas time, so he could watch, you know, whatever movie. And I took a look at it, and I was like, wow. I mean, I'm sort of sitting there thinking, I can't believe this is so popular, because I'm used to, you know, I'm used to watching, like, Blu-rays and stuff.
Yeah,
and it looks. Well, I guess it's maybe a little bit worse than a regular DVD would look. It's not the best quality, and that's I mean, that's basically a function of the bandwidth that they're using. So, I mean, at any point, they could just flip a switch and it could look better. But right now, you're right. It doesn't, at least, you know, standard movies. I don't know, specifically MLB or UFC. But, it could look better, is what I'm trying to say.
The iPad, I just want to go back to this very quickly because this is a question that a lot of people had before the new iPad came out. They were making comparisons to the iPhone screen, which it's a Retina display. And, you know, a lot of people were like, oh, the iPad 2 may have a Retina display. And I guess the deal is that a Retina display on a screen the size of an iPad 2 would be so ridiculously expensive that you essentially could not create it for consumer use. Is that basically correct?
As I understand it, I mean, I don't think Apple has come out and said something that concrete, but I wouldn't be surprised. It's sort of like what I said earlier, that these companies have these things, you know, in their warehouse, so to speak, and they're just waiting for it to become price, you know, the price is right, so
sure.
to speak. I mean, the rumor is that the iPad 3 in the fall will definitely be like almost like a renaissance of the like a rebirth of the iPad idea. So I would say maybe hold off until the fall before you know, condemning Apple for not releasing the Retina display quite yet. It would not surprise me that it's just too expensive right now to produce a screen that much bigger at that dense pixel density. So.
One last iPad question here, since today is release day. When you when you followed the rumors prior to even the announcement that the iPad 2 was being released, how did the rumors compare to what actually ended up being released? Were there things that you were sort of blown away by? Were there things that you were disappointed in? Was it all that you expected? Was it less than you expected? How would you compare the rumors to what was actually produced?
Probably about right on what we expected. I mean, a lot of these things, they're produced in factories in China and East Asia and everything. So pictures do leak out of like, oh, that's very clearly the front camera slot. That's very clearly, you know, feature X. So these things, they do get out, and there were really no surprises. Most people, when they saw what Steve Jobs actually unveiled, they were like, yeah, that's pretty much what we expected. So I don't think anyone was too disappointed with what he released. But at the end, like about a few days before the iPad 2 was actually unveiled, we started seeing things about like iPad 3. Like this iPad 2 is just sort of like a bump in, you know, a bump up. It's nothing really to get too excited about. What you really want, you know, if you can hold off for a few months because the iPad 3 will be the one to look at. So it's just always. It always feels like you're constantly waiting for, like, don't get this because in a few months there'll be an even better one. I mean, at some point you have to, if you want it, you have to get it.
I say just buy it and then sell it to your co-host on the radio when the new one comes out.
Yeah, you could do that. I've heard that story.
Kind of the way I'm looking to do it here now. I want to get to a couple of questions from the board. Actually, one last iPad question. The thickness of it now, it is much thinner than the original version. How does it compare to a MacBook Air screen? Not the entire computer, just the screen of the MacBook Air. And can you see a time where perhaps, if it's not now, it would be as thin as just the screen of a MacBook Air?
That'll be difficult. I mean, There are still chips in there that need to be in there that you're going to need a certain amount of, I guess, thickness. So it's hard to have, like, just a screen.
Yeah.
So it'll be, I mean, it's a little bit thinner than the first. It's not a huge reduction, and I'm sure the iPad 3 will be all that much thinner, but I don't know if we're going to look at an iPad, let's say 4, where it's all screen. I mean, there's certain limitations of the physics involved, so I don't know about that.
This actually goes for the iPad and the iPhone. But if you look around online, you know, for some reason, a lot of people wanted a white iPhone, and I could never see what the big deal was with a white iPhone. Why this was so important to certain people, but. You know, if you Google white iPhone, sometimes you'll see a graphic of a see-through iPhone. It's like just a sheet of glass with the graphics on it. And obviously, it's a mock-up that somebody did.
Right.
But do you see it perhaps at some point moving to something like that, where it's just, it is essentially a sheet of glass and all of the, wherever the chips are, everything like that, I don't know. But right. It certainly looked pretty cool.
I mean, yeah, that's a different thing, like the shell of the device. I mean, there's no reason. I mean, there was a rumor that I think it was the iPad 3. It's going to use like carbon fiber, like one of those super, you know, supercars or whatever. So there are experiments with different materials of the outer shell. So yeah, I could see like it maybe being an all glass thing. But there are other considerations in there. Like Apple ran into a lot of trouble with the iPhone 4. And like reception issues because of the way they changed the back, so there's a certain like limitation as to what type of materials you can use. But I guess there could be like a see-through shell. I mean, there's no reason why there wouldn't be, and whether or not it's made of glass, that would depend again on not just whether or not they can make it physically work, but whether or not they can sort of get the signals that they need to get in and out of the phone with this new material. So.
Couple of other quick cell phone questions, and we'll wrap up with some of the questions from the board. You mentioned the iPhone 4 and the antenna, I guess. I'm holding mine right now. They're at the bottom, basically on the side near the bottom, there are these two divots in the middle part of the phone. And when you hold this phone like you would a normal phone, your pinky covers one and your palm covers the other. And there were people initially that were like, oh my God, when this gets covered, I get no reception. And yep. I never had that problem. So I guess the question is, was that even real? Or was that an issue with AT&T and people just presumed, oh my God, I'm covering these things, I'm getting no reception here?
Apple gave their official explanation for that whole situation was that there was actually a glitch in their software that misrepresented like the actual signal quality that the phone is actually getting versus what is being displayed on the screen. So they admitted to that, to at least that. And the other side of that is that when you saw those videos on YouTube where people were like, oh, my reception is dying, it sort of emerged that a lot of that was happening in areas where they just had weak cell phone coverage to begin with.
Sure.
So, I mean, if you're already in an area where you're susceptible to your phone cutting out, this sort of, I guess, glitch just sort of exacerbated the problem. I don't know if it was a completely Apple messed up, but it was an issue, and they did their best to fix it. But I don't know if it was the end of the world. A lot of people were really upset with Apple there for a little bit, and they admitted they're part of the problem. But I mean, like you alluded to, AT&T. Doesn't really have the best reputation for cell phone coverage as far as certain parts of the country are concerned. So it was pretty much the perfect storm of this little glitch and that little glitch all coming together, and then it seemed like, oh my God, what's going on?
And the final phone question, what are your thoughts on just the dangers of cell phones? Because there have been some studies that seem to indicate that there might be some dangers associated with using cell phones for long periods of time. There are studies that don't show any sort of danger, and there's no real answer right now. I think they would just largely recommend don't be on your phone all day long, just in case.
Right.
But what do you feel about this? And as technology advances, I mean, I don't know anything about, you know, I don't build radios or anything like that, but I don't know if you know, for example, an iPhone that is you know, got a glass face and a glass back, I don't know if that would make any difference, positive or negative. I mean, is technology increasing in such a way that, I mean, obviously now your phone shouldn't get hot if you're using it for long periods of time like it used to. So are things changing here?
Well, your first question, whether or not phones can harm you. I think the best answer you could give right now would be that there's really just not enough data. Like, these things haven't been around long enough to know one way or the other whether or not they are harmful or they are harmless. I think that's just a function of how long they've been around. That said, I mean, radio, like just, you know, radio waves, you know, radio commercial radio stations, they've been around for a while, and it doesn't seem like the whole population is suffering some sort of radio-induced, problems. So, I mean, if we've lived amongst radio waves for all these years, it's sort of hard to think that cell phone signals are all the worse. But the issue is, the fact is, we just don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as simple as that. There haven't been enough studies, and we haven't been around them long enough to know if maybe, you know, maybe if you were exposed to them from, you know, from your kid, from when you were a kid on, that maybe you'll develop something later in life. We won't know until that kid is you know, 80 years old, and he's grown up with phones all his life. We're just not at that point yet, so.
Well, I mean, at the same time, people have been using cell phones, and probably far more dangerous cell phones, if there is a danger to them, for a long time now, and I don't know. I don't want to downplay it. I would just think that if there were, like, this direct correlation and it was a massively dangerous thing, we'd certainly have, you know, far more evidence than we do right now. It's kind of like, you know, I put a picture on Facebook once of me. I was basically sitting there with my cat and my laptop is on my lap, and people were like, oh my God, don't put your laptop there. You'll lower your sperm count. And,
right.
You know, the reason for that, I guess, is your laptop heats up and that sort of deal. But what if I just have a cat sitting on my lap? You know what I mean? Isn't that going to do the same thing? Warm up my genital area? I don't know. I don't know why we came to that subject right there, but all right, let's do a couple of questions here from the board. This person said, when I was a kid, many teachers told us we would grow up to drive flying cars. I guess this was in the Jetsons era. Any progress in this area? Because I don't see it happening despite constant traffic increases in metropolitan areas.
Well, the funny, I think of his Michio Kaku, I'm not sure, or someone of his ilk, who said that the idea of a flying car isn't all that bad, because if we get cars up off the ground, there's a lot of room up there where you could have cars sort of, you know, it's up into the atmosphere. And if you look at things like the Google car that does the Google Street View, that pretty much drives itself. So if you were to somehow combine, like, let's say a flying car, but automate that where you don't have to have people now all of a sudden trying to navigate, you know, three axes of space-time, it might work. I mean, the other issue is that if the technology were to be developed where you could have some sort of personal, like, flying transportation device, the actual, let's say, implementation of that, like, on the roads, it would just be chaos. Like, how hard is it to get, like, a driver's license? You have to wait in the DMV forever. Like, there'd be a lot of, like, regulation, you know, regulatory, like, hurdles and stuff like that. Like, the technology we can develop may be fine, maybe very easily, but it would be actually, like, getting that into the world of you know, citizens and getting them on the road and making sure everything works out safely. There's a lot involved in that, and people seem to have a hard enough time just driving on the roads.
Yeah,
with that.
That's half
so
the reason there's traffic, is people can't drive. You expect these people to fly?
Yeah, I mean that's why the idea, if you could automate that like regular airplanes. I mean, they pretty much fly themselves as it is. I mean, pilots are really only used on like takeoff and landing, but when they're up there, they're pretty much flying themselves. So the idea, if you could take a flying car, so to speak, and a lot of that is automated, maybe, but it would just be such a radical change that it would be very difficult to see that, you know, anytime soon.
I don't want to keep you on the show all day, but I have so many questions. I got to ask you about the Google car real quick. So the Google car operates through Street View?
I don't even know. You asked me this, and I feel like a weirdo. I don't even know how it drives, and all I know is that it all but drives itself. I don't know the specifics of that.
Well, the reason I ask is because I live in a new development here, and still, if you Google Maps or Street View my house, you see dirt. And whenever I order pizza, you know, unless I tell them exactly what to do, their Google Maps, because they use Google Maps, they don't use a map like in the old days, like real navigators, you know, they'll always end up across the street in another development because their Street View doesn't register my house as even existing yet. So I mean, how would that affect your Google car? I mean, I would presume you've got to have a Google car that you could override it. You know, you don't want to say, take me home, and it takes you a mile away, or maybe there's a new street, or it drives you into a tree, you know?
Well, I mean, theoretically, that's just all on like, GPS. Like, if your house, as it exists now, it has the same coordinates as the plot of dirt that was there before. So if you give the guy, you know, here's where I am, he should be able to find you. I don't know why he's going across the way like that. That's sort of weird.
And this person here, will natural motion gaming technology, the Wii, PlayStation Move, Microsoft Kinect, or natural language software progress to the point of becoming the prominent method of accessing technology? In other words, will you ask your computer to turn on and manipulate it by pointing at things instead of with a keyboard and a mouse?
Well, it's funny you ask that now because in the past couple of days, Microsoft and Sony, they announced that they're going to open up the Sony Move and the Microsoft Kinect to like universities and hobbyists and other non-commercial uses, so that very soon we will have like a group of coders working on that type of thing. So maybe in a few months, you know, in a few months we'll actually see that you can navigate your Windows, you know, your Windows 7 just using your hands, sort of like that movie that with Tom Cruise that I forget.
Oh, Minority Report.
Minority Report, yeah, yeah. Maybe. But that you ask that now. Literally, just wait a few months because these people are just starting to open up these platforms to those type of ideas. So give it. I'm not saying give it years. Actually, just give it a few months and we'll see what develops because that's going to be developing actually pretty soon. So it's funny to guess that.
Well, Nicholas, I want you to plug everything that you've got coming up at crunchgear.com. I want to say that this show was awesome. And if you are down with it, I'd like to get you on like every couple of months just to talk about new stuff. Because obviously, as you just noted, new stuff is happening like all the time. So plug your stuff and I'd love to have you back.
Yeah, I'm always around, so that's not an issue. I guess the only plug is crunchgear.com. It's that's the website. We talk about a little bit of everything. And check us out. I mean, there's really nothing more to it than that. So.
Well, I want to thank you very much for doing the show. Like I said, it was awesome. This is one of my favorite shows that I've ever done. And hopefully we can do it again regularly because I love this kind of thing. And you were a great guest. So thanks again. Check out crunchgear.com, everybody. And that is it from here. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And have a good night.